go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined with our new super producer, ladies and gentlemen, Tyler Klang. Tyler, you want to put an applause cue in there? Okay.
Hooray, new producer.
And it's good to see you, man.
Likewise.
It feels like a little while since we've been back in the booth.
Yeah, it does. It seems like it's been a couple of weeks, but it probably hasn't. I mean, well, you know how we do these things. We do them in little batches here and there. So
yeah.
We try to be pretty topical with our topics, but it doesn't always work out that way. In fact, today's comes from back in May, May of this year, which is good, not May of last year. Sometimes that happens, but but I think it's an interesting topic, and hopefully we can. What do you think? Do you think we could stretch this to an hour? We always can, right? Doesn't matter what we're talking about. Seems like we can draw this out, right?
Sometimes we end up going on tangents. I've listened to previous episodes where, and it's usually my fault, where for some reason I'm irritated about something that I have to just get on a soapbox and rant about for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I will say, though, in my defense, that usually when I listen back, I agree.
Yeah, and you know what? You agree with what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
I agree with my rants. Yeah.
Understood. I get it. But, yeah, we do get off on some tangents sometimes, and I think we might have this have that opportunity again today, because it seems like this topic I want to say this up front. I'm glad we're, you know, kind of chit-chatting here before
we
really dive into it, but – I do understand that, you know, today's topic is going to have a lot of people saying, wait, you forgot about this. And there's going to be several angles and several different ways to look at this topic.
Angles.
So, angles. Funny. Yeah. So I think that, you know, by the end of today, we will hopefully have, you know, not 100% answered the question, but close to it anyways. There's a lot of other dimensions that we're not looking at or other things that we're not considering. I understand that up front. So please, you know, after you listen to today's episode, write in, tell us what we're forgetting, what we're not, you know, understanding about this whole process.
Because
we're not engineers, we're not designers, we're not stylists, we're not accountants. But we are going to try to describe to you why your car is so boring. And this comes from an article that was in Jalopnik, and it was written by a professional. It was written by a guy that is a car designer. He just goes by Mr. Car Designer. He wants to remain anonymous. But he is a design engineer, and he's also a car enthusiast who will lead us down a pathway that explains why, you know, that economy car that you bought or even that, you know, mid-level sedan is somewhat boring.
Right. And I think this has happened to everyone in traffic, especially in the past, what do you want to say, for decades now. You've probably been in traffic if you're listening to this show and you've looked around once or twice and just glanced to the left, glanced to the right, and you think, God, these cars are all so generic.
Absolutely. I don't know how many people have written in and said, why does everything look the same? Why do all cars seem to be taking the same form? And that goes for trucks in some situations as well. Not all of them. There are some standouts, of course. And same with cars. There are going to be some standouts. But when you look at just general traffic, when you're just, again, just sitting in you know, bumper-to-bumper traffic during rush hour, you're going to notice that just about every SUV looks very, very similar. Every sedan looks very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And same with economy cars, same with, you know, hatchbacks, same with sedans, whatever.
Sure.
They all follow roughly the same form, and there's probably a good reason for that. Now, we're going to maybe we won't discuss this in depth, but there's something to be said for brand identity. So, you know, there are certain key characteristics that cars carry that, you know, all of the product line carries. You know,
must have this grill.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example. You know, it's a look that they all follow. You know, you can tell that that's a Jeep from a long distance away because it has that characteristic Jeep form,
mm-hmm.
you know, that type of thing. So we understand all that, but there are some really good reasons why, you know, and maybe this is a better way to say it, Ben.
Okay.
I've heard this from many people throughout, you know, decades. And I've often wondered this myself. Why can't they make a car that is, you know, an economy car, a $15,000 car, just to be fair.
Okay.
$15,000 car that has the looks of a Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
It's very small. Like, let's say it's just a scaled-down Corvette.
Okay.
But it's $15,000. Why can't they do that? Why can't they make an economy Corvette-looking car, or something that looks like a Jaguar F-Type, or something like that. Why aren't small cars, economy cars, more sporty looking? Why aren't they – or why are they so simple? Why are they so plain?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people ask that. Why can't they just add some style? Why can't they add some of the finishes that make everything look nice inside, you know, the quilted interiors, that kind
of
thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's probably one good answer – One four-letter word that everybody can probably guess, and that's cost.
Mm-hmm.
And it all comes down to cost, really. But
cost per unit.
But there are lots of reasons, really.
Yeah, there's more to this story than there may appear to be on the surface. So one of the things that you, friends and neighbors, have written in to tell us before was that cars are increasingly becoming generic because it's a matter of science, specifically aerodynamics. Mm-hmm. And while there is some sand to that, while I do agree that is part of the reason behind boring design, it's not the entire reason whatsoever. And as we explore this, we're going to, with the help of our anonymous whistleblower, we are going to discover some new twists and turns to the story. How do you think we want to set this up? I like how he takes the bloom off the rose really quickly.
I do like that too. And you know what? I don't want to start in with the article, and we'll read some of this article, uh-huh. I promise. But I want you to cast your mind back to the 1980s and 1990s for a moment and think about the economy cars from back then.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so a lot of them had very, very flat panels, very mm-hmm. simple stamp designs, very easy mm-hmm. to you can imagine them being manufactured very easy.
Right, right.
At scale. I mean, you know, when they're going to make 20,000 of them, 30,000 of them, very simple to build, very simple to make.
And then they have
and very plain.
Yeah, and they're plain. And part of the reason they're plain is because the components are built to be used in multiple models, you know?
Yeah, sure. That's part of the reason. But but think about now, like in as we get to, you know, the 2017 model year, economy cars have made a pretty dramatic step forward, I guess, in that, you know, there are a lot of really – simple vehicles that still have a little bit of style. You know, they've really, I guess, I don't know if they've upped their game so much as more as just they've refined it to the point where there's just a little bit of style to it. It's not so boxy. It's not so flat. It's not, you know, the cars have more bends and creases to them. They're a little bit sexier looking, I guess,
yeah,
if you want to call it that.
There's a little more flow.
Yeah, I mean, if you can call a Kia Rio, you know, a sexy car, I don't know if you can or not, but you know, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you look at cars like the Smart for Two or the Chevy Spark or the Sonic or, you know, something like that, or Mitsubishi Mirage even. They have a little bit of design flair to them, but not a whole lot. And I guess I just want to remind people of that you know, they have made some advancements, I guess, along the way. But you're right, Ben. The way that this starts out, he does quickly get right to the point.
Yes. Imagine you've just been hired as a design engineer at a major automotive manufacturer, says Mr. Car Designer. Your boss introduces himself and says, "Hey, are you ready to design the most innovative, mind-blowing, original car you've ever seen?" Now stop imagining that, because your boss is not going to say that. Maybe Elon Musk says that to his new recruits as they walk through the door. Then he probably mutters something under his breath about tunnels in the parking lot.
Yeah, okay. So that's every designer's dream, or every engineer's dream, right? Is that like you finally get to do what you've went to school for so many years. You're ready to design the coolest, you know, most badass car that you can imagine on the planet, even though, you know, you're designing an economy car or a base level vehicle. But that's not the case. He says on his first day as a career designer, his boss says, "We're considering removing the dampers on our glove boxes. I need you to benchmark other manufacturers to make sure our cars won't be seen as lower quality compared to the competition. Prepare a presentation, and then we'll start training you on how to fill out the paperwork necessary to make the change." So that is the excitement that design engineering has today. That's what a typical design engineer will look forward to on their first day.
And as a rookie designer at this point in their time, Mr. Car Designer also had to point out that they were car enthusiasts. This was a real eye-opening peek behind the curtain for them, because, like, I love that you brought up Jaguar and Corvette, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing vehicles, just from the visual profile.
Sure.
Not even counting the engineering that goes into the engine and the powertrain and stuff. When we see those sorts of cars, you know, those are the sorts of vehicles that inspire kids to go to school and become a designer,
mm-hmm.
you know? But he wants to give us all what would you call it, a splash of cold water?
Sure.
On this. And one of the first things he talks about is what engineering actually is. What do design engineers actually do?
Yeah, because everybody wants to point the finger at the engineers and say it's their fault. They're the reason behind this boring design.
I've got a great example of kicking a probably innocent engineer.
Okay, what's that?
So the Monte Carlo, my old Monte Carlo, had this terrible design for placement of the battery, mm-hmm. and it had a metal strut atop it. And the battery is placed in sideways, so you had to undo the strut first to get to the battery. And, of course, I would rather have it be vertical versus horizontal. Mm-hmm. And every time you've got a dead battery, you know, you're not in the mood to think, oh, I understand the economy of space at play here. Instead, you're thinking, why the hell do I need another wrench?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you got to be prepared for it no matter where you are if you have to swap that out or do whatever you have to do. So, yeah, I mean, I can see that people get angry and frustrated at certain things on their vehicles and they say, well, why is that designed that way? Why did they do that? Why did they make that choice? That's such a dumb choice. But there are a lot of reasons behind that. And it doesn't just fall on the shoulders of the engineers. There are three main groups that exist within any automotive company, according to Mr. Car Designer. And he says, short of Hot Wheels, he says, you know, Hot Wheels is a different game. But there's the engineering group, styling, and accounting. And then you also throw in another group that's really important. And we'll talk about these guys at the end. The government. Now, everybody has to deal with the government because all the cars that you produce have to comply with certain regulations, of course. And there are hundreds of regulations that we'll talk about. Now, all of them play a role in shaping the car that you end up buying or decide, you know, you don't want to buy because of the way it's designed or the way it looks or whatever, you know, whatever reason you may have against them. So he starts out with engineering, which is a logical place to begin because that's what his focus is, his study is in.
Mm-hmm.
And you might wonder exactly what design engineers really do since we've said, you know, they're not entirely responsible for this.
So right. Engineers
are responsible for designing, as he says, the clips, ribs, brackets, frames, hinges, wires, supports, springs, shafts, and anything else that comprises the structural or functional parts of a car. So they're responsible for making sure that, you know, things don't rattle when you go over the railroad tracks, making sure things don't shake loose after, mm-hmm. you know, you hit 10 speed bumps, that type of thing.
And a good engineer can make your $20,000 car feel high quality. Alternatively, he says, a bad engineer can make your $80,000 car feel like a drunk toddler made the dashboard out of paper mache. And we've seen that in some more high-end cars, especially, and not to ding them too much because I know we've talked about it in previous episodes, but especially when you see upper-scale brands try to make economy cars, but they still have this upper scale brand price point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Nobody wants to do that.
You know what? Can I mention something now that we're talking about price point? Because and we'll get right back into the story
in just a minute.
This is one of those side stories that I think we need to talk about. Now, we've mentioned that, you know, we're probably going to talk about price of vehicles, you know, why they price them the way they do, I guess, you know, why certain brands can get away or certain manufacturers can get away with making inexpensive vehicles and others mm-hmm. can't. All right. So what do you think the cheapest new car for 2017 is? The cheapest model year vehicle for 2017? And you may already know this. I may be asking a loaded question here.
The absolute cheapest in the U.S.
Yeah. Just a guess. A wild guess.
I don't know if I could do a specific vehicle. Maybe I can try to guess for a company.
Okay.
Is it Kia? Is it Hyundai?
It is not.
What is it?
It is Nissan. Nissan builds the 2017 Nissan Versa sedan, and the starting price for a brand new 2017. $12,825. I find that remarkable.
Let's get a couple.
That's pretty good.
That price is so low that it sounds like it's, you know, a buy four, get one free deal.
But have you ever seen a Nissan Versa sedan?
I have not seen the 2017. I have seen plenty of Nissan Versas, and they're not my favorite.
All right, they're relatively plain vehicles. And
sure.
You're also going to have to deal with hand crank windows, manual power locks. You know, we're talking about the base S sedan. They're also not going to have any kind of height adjustable driver's seat, no center armrest. you know, for the driver or the passenger.
Wow.
There's no folding rear seats. You know, it's just that they're upright and the trunk is the trunk. It doesn't allow
any, that's how it stays.
Doesn't allow any extra space or anything like that. But what you do get, and this is kind of surprising for that price.
Yeah.
You do get things like air conditioning, power mirrors. You get a four speaker stereo system with audio controls on the steering wheel, which is kind of nice for that price point.
Yeah.
You get things like Bluetooth connectivity. I mean, it has a lot of features that you would be surprised would come on a less than $13,000 car, but you know, at this still, you're looking at a fairly, and I shouldn't say primitive vehicle, but it's
basic. It's bare bones.
Well, it's bare bones. Yeah. It's really stripped down, I guess. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not loaded by any means. It's got, a scarcity of amenities, maybe.
Yeah. That's a good way to say it. And I am on the same page with you there, man. That is surprising that the same vehicle that would not have a center armrest has steering wheel audio controls. It makes me think, and I'm just guessing here, but it makes me wonder if in their supply chain that's the only steering wheel they make now.
Well, see, that might be it. This might be the result of a trickle down technology issue.
I think that's it.
Where instead of designing an all new steering wheel, as you said, you know, for this Nissan Versa, they just simply use it from the Altima or something like that. And I'm making that up. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a possibility.
It might be all Nissan sedans.
That could be.
It could be.
Yeah, it could be that simple. And that's the thing. This trickle down technology. Oftentimes, that's why a manufacturer will build a halo car, something that draws the customers in, has them look at the vehicle that's on the showroom floor, and then the people end up buying, a model or two that's a trim line lower, maybe two lower than that one.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still excited about the product. They're excited about, in this case, Nissan.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It happens. I mean, it happens with all brands. They all have these halo cars that we've discussed in the past.
Get them in the dealership.
Yeah,
as long as they walk out with something, right?
Yeah, hook them with something, and then and then reel them in with something else. Maybe that's it, right?
Yeah.
All right. So back to maybe what we were talking about before, and I guess we're talking about engineering. We hadn't really gotten too far into this, but I think this is really funny. Now he goes on to say, we talked about all the little bits and pieces and the minutiae that they design and work on through their whole career. Really, I mean the brackets and frames and hinges and all that stuff. Right now. This is a funny way to put this. There's humor throughout this whole article, really.
Yeah, which I appreciate.
So I'll
you
read
can
this.
You see why he's out anonymous.
Now, he says, if you're interested in seeing the work that engineers like myself do, remove a plastic part from your car. You might notice the curved, styled surface and the way the grain of the plastic feels. Now, forget about all that and flip it over. You see those ribs that run across the surface? The little clip towers adorned with those Christmas tree clips that everyone hates? That's what I design. My life is awesome. So he designs like the stuff that you just don't see, the stuff that that matters behind the face of the vehicle, really.
But these things are mission critical every time you drive.
Exactly, because it adds to the durability, the reliability of the vehicle, and engineers are responsible for stuff like that, so that they make sure that the car will last; it won't fall apart on the way home from the dealership.
And there's another part that he points out that I think it's valid. And it's a very well-written point. He preemptively responds to folks in the audience, including, honestly, me at the beginning of our research here, who would say, well, engineering, what about the people who make the engines and the transmissions? You know, they're doing the real gearhead work. And then he responds with, yes, but at the end of the day, their job isn't that much different from his own because they don't just decide they're going to throw an 11,000 RPM V12 in the next Kia Rio. And then this is one of my favorite sentences, and it's so true. He points out some guy out there has spent months of his life designing a dipstick.
Yeah. Just chew on that for just a moment. Just think about that. You spend months designing a part that relatively few people will ever really give much of a second thought to.
Or even differentiate between when they get a different car. Very few people are going to, check the oil and then go, oh, wow, what an amazing and innovative dipstick.
Yeah. So the engineers, again, they're responsible for making sure that everything has integrity, durability, reliability. And the thing is that a lot of people, you know, they think that the engineers are responsible for style, the way that the car looks. And that's not necessarily the case. But the group that is responsible for that is styling. And that's a group that we're going to talk about after our word from our sponsor. And we're back, and we were talking about styling. And styling, now that's the people that are responsible for what the car looks like. I mean, when you get into a vehicle, what the interior looks like, you know, what it looks like from the outside, how it catches your eye, how it turns your head, how it probably drew you to it at the dealership to begin with, really. That's the styling group. And that's but they're not entirely responsible for it. So this is what we'll talk about.
Right,
now,
right.
Remember, the engineers are going to push back with, yeah, that piece looks really great, but, you know, it has to have this ribbing underneath in order to make it structurally strong enough to hold up. And they're going to say, well, then that changes the design of it. So it's back and forth, right? So
right.
There's a continual push and pull among all these groups that we're going to talk about. And styling, you know, sure, they start out with a fantastic design, something that's swoopy and maybe even muscular. You know, it's a bold design, something
sure.
that they really want. And that's what you typically see in concept vehicles at auto shows.
I knew you were going to say
some amazing looking designs and vehicles, but everybody knows that by the time that vehicle goes to production, it looks significantly different in most cases.
Right, because it's to some degree it has to be collaboratively created, right? So as Scott said, the engineers will come in and say, okay, I know we all love the Jetsons, but it's impossible to do that. Can we do a regular windshield?
Yeah. We're not going to do a glass dome like you wanted on that vehicle, even though it looks really cool.
And there are concept cars that have those, but there's a reason that, you know, your next Nissan Versa doesn't have a glass dome.
Yeah, you're not driving under like a fighter jet canopy or something like that,
right,
which would be so cool, but you just can't do it. Now, I know, again, concept vehicles have that and they look amazing, but there's a reason behind that. And the problem is that, you know, everyone wants to design what they deem to be the most beautiful or most sleek car in the world, right?
Yeah.
And designers can do that. They can pick up a pen and paper and draw out what looks like the greatest car ever. And you think, that's fantastic. If you could build that, I would buy one.
A group of engineers and a group of designers can realistically sit down in a room, hash it out, and make a car that looks and performs at this amazingly high standard. However, they're not the only people in the room, and we can't just – it's easy to say – so-and-so ruined the new generation of my favorite sports car, right?
Sure.
But it's also unfair to put the blame just on the designers. These are not spaced out knuckleheads or something who wake up one day from a dream and say, this is the new Chevy Malibu,
A fever dream.
A fever dream, right.
That's right. No. Yeah. As you said, there are other people in the room. And those other people are the accountants. And we'll get to accountants in just a moment, but it all comes back to, as you had guessed, or as probably everybody guessed, and we said earlier, it all comes back to cost. Everything costs money, so nice things cost a lot of money. And if you want to build an economy car, it's all about cutting corners where you can, while still adhering to the safety regulations and still adhering to, I guess the principles behind the brand and what they stand for and what they want to put forward as their image, but. More than that, they're still interested in cost. Cost is number one.
Cost is king.
Okay. Should I say cost is number one? Because they are when you get down to the brass tacks of it, I guess, safety is what eventually rules everything.
Safety is eventually what – safety ultimately. I would say safety, marketability, and cost.
Yeah.
And the reason I would put marketability up there is because it doesn't matter how smart you are in – the manufacturing rooms, if no one wants to buy it, you're still up the creek.
Okay, so they talk a little bit about profit margins. All right, now this is kind of surprising, and I read this somewhere. I don't remember where it was. It was in some forum somewhere, and engineers had added material to it. I don't remember exactly where to credit this to, but Someone said that economy cars are, you know, lower-end base model vehicles. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the profit margin on those vehicles might be as little as $1,000.
And this is amazing. I'm really glad you mentioned this because I have an analogy for us, a comparison.
All right. So, you know, what we're talking about, mm-hmm. though, and we'll get to your analogy in just a second, but what we're talking about is that every vehicle they sell, they only gain back $1,000. Now, imagine that you have built this vehicle from the ground up. It's a scratch-built vehicle, I'd say, and it's a brand-new line. Let's say it's the new Dodge Dart.
Okay.
All right. I was going to use the Neon, but the Neon's long gone. So let's say the new Dodge Dart. And you've got all the tooling together, and we're talking about sometimes millions of dollars for tools that go into this. You know, for each panel, each piece, you know, it gets very, very expensive. Of course, the research and development, all the people that go into building that, all the time that they've put into it. You're paying for engineers for, you know, maybe 2 years, 3 years to develop this vehicle, whatever it takes.
And there's testing that also – there's testing where you're essentially wrecking series of these cars.
Sure, yeah. there's just countless costs that go into this thing. Yeah. And they're recapturing only, let's say, $1,000 for every one they sell. Mm-hmm. The only way that works is if you build – you know, 20,000 of these a year, 30,000 of them a year, maybe hundreds of thousands of them. And over the lifetime of the car, eventually it pays it back. Now, we're not talking about even 1 year. We're talking about over a span of, you know, the generation of the vehicle before they have to retool it for a new generation. So that adds more costs. So let's say that, you know, it has a 5-year run without a change. And that'd be a long time, I think, these days without a change.
Yeah, it's true.
A significant change. You know, they're recapturing $1,000 every time they sell one. Mm. You need to sell, you know, hundreds of thousands of vehicles in order to recapture that cost or to gain a profit on that line of vehicles. And sometimes it just doesn't happen. Sometimes they decide to just get rid of the line. Other times they decide, well, we'll retool it, make it more attractive, and maybe we'll get more sales. And, you know, this goes back and this kind of just snowballs into bigger things as you keep going on. So, again, that scale, you know, you have to build it at that level, that amount of vehicles every year, or that amount of vehicles for the generation. That's something they have to factor in right at the very beginning. Like, is this really going to be worth it? Is this something that people are going to want to buy?
Right. And the analogy that I would draw, or one of the ways I like to picture it, mainly because I skipped lunch earlier today, is let's think about what we buy in a grocery store. Or let's think about the economics of a grocery store versus the economics of a really fancy restaurant.
Okay.
So in a really fancy restaurant, let's say you're taking your significant other out and I don't know, it's like your anniversary, your wife was always wanting to go to, your husband's always wanting to go to this special place, right? And you know that you could, you will be paying a premium for what may be, you know, like a relatively small steak or something, and then a side of béarnaise sauce. I don't know. I don't know what you eat. But you're already creating such a high profit margin for that restaurant if we're just looking at materials and we're just looking at sort of the design of the thing. And a grocery store – the point is a high-end restaurant can – produce more profit through fewer transactions, but a grocery store, which has maybe a profit of as small as three to 4 cents on a can of beans, you know, they have to sell hundreds.
Yeah.
Just to like keep the lights on.
So at the steakhouse, let's say,
sure.
You're paying $55 for a ribeye steak, which you know doesn't cost them $55, but they have a big profit margin. They can sell less steaks and still make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That's like the Ferrari of steaks.
Yeah.
Okay, got
that's
it.
That's what I'm saying.
You go to the grocery store, you buy a ribeye steak, and it's let's say it's $23.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the grocery store is only making $3 on that sale because it cost them $20 to get that meat from the butcher wherever they get it, right? That's like the Nissan Versa of steaks.
Yeah. I'm going to pull that quote out of context and just quote you later on that because that's cool. But yeah, I think that holds up because I'm really glad you said Ferrari because that's why you don't see huge runs of very high-end cars. they don't have to exist.
Well, they're also they're going to throw in another complication. Not a complication, but maybe another angle consideration. Yes, is that those are primarily hand built. I know they're using some robotics at Ferrari for our example here, but
yeah, that's true. That's really important.
Primarily hand assembled vehicles, so there's a lot more time and effort put into them, and they can do things in a lot of cases that a robot can't do. Now I know that it's pretty limitless what you can do with robotics these days. I understand that, but on a relatively simple, if I can call it simple, assembly line now, where a car is primarily built with robotics, you look at what they do, and it's a relatively simple operation. Everything loads in through the car door. It's pretty easy to get in with the robotic arm and weld and fasten or whatever they have to do, right? Apply,
sure,
finishes, whatever. That all happens relatively easy. But a craftsman that is creating a Ferrari by hand, someone that, maybe 12 people on the line.
They're in there,
whatever,
like stitching the upholstery and stuff.
Exactly right. Yeah, there's a big difference there, right? I mean, you're not going to see a robotic arm stitching the steering wheel together on a Nissan Versa. You're going to see them, taking a pre-assembled steering wheel and applying it to the vehicle.
Just like at the restaurant, there is a chef cooking.
Well, exactly. That's right. Yeah. So there's, and I know I'm oversimplifying that whole thing, but you get the point. These cars are simple design. They're repeatable, to the point where you can build, tens or hundreds of thousands of them a year. I don't know about hundreds. That's a lot, but you could build lots of them quickly.
Yeah.
The other version is one that you build very few slowly.
Yeah. And this leads us back. If we go back to the conceptual process of building an economy car, just like Scott mentioned, anything that the designers, even the engineers, think would be really cool doesn't always get in. Anything that they think is cool that other parts of the decision-making group think are unnecessary are probably going to get cut.
Yeah. Now that means things like, brake cooling ducts, intakes for brakes and things like that, fancy aero tech, as he puts it, trick suspensions, or even crazy shaped, difficult to produce body panels or nicks. Now that's a huge one right there.
Yeah. That makes me think of, remember when carbon fiber first came out?
Yeah, I do remember that and how difficult that was to make, any body panel really. I mean, now they're starting to simplify that. It's starting to be mass produced and it's getting a lot cheaper to do that. But carbon fiber was so expensive to work with in the early days, even of this podcast. It was a nightmare.
Right?
Yeah, it was a really difficult process. But all that stuff that, they think is unnecessary gets cut from the vehicle. Anything that, the accounting group thinks is unnecessary, they get rid of it. And, again, one of the biggest things, I think, this is the exterior sheet metal. Now, I had mentioned this early in the podcast that a lot of people just simply want a better designed compact car, economy car. Why can't you make it look like that Corvette? Or why can't you make it look like, a Hummer when it's just a little vehicle, a little tiny compact vehicle? Why do you have to make it so complex? How much could a crease in metal possibly cost, right?
Uh-huh.
But that's not all there is to it. It's not just adding the style to the outside. It's not just the bolt-on stuff, really. You got to think about everything behind that. Everything that the engineers are responsible for making. Making sure that stuff doesn't fall off. Making sure that it's supported in some way. Making sure that later, as we'll talk about, crash standards. The regulations.
Yeah,
that's a big part of it. There's again, everything that we talk about here just again snowballs into something much, much bigger. But the good news is that manufacturers still can get away with adding stuff like that to the vehicle. They still can add aerotech. They still can add trick suspensions. They can still add the brake cooling ducts or intakes if they want to. But it's going to be not on the base model. It's going to be on the mid-level lines or even the high-line vehicles.
It's the trim package. It's the optional. It's the option that, honestly, this stuff irritates the heck out of me, Scott. It's the option that makes you think, well, why would you sell a car without that?
Yeah.
And we can promise you a lot of engineers and a lot of designers, like a lot of stylists, probably thought the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
They were probably like, no, this suspension is important. And they're like, it's not – it might be important, but important isn't the same thing as necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you really need the brand name struts on this, or can we just put in, the ones that we buy from our supplier?
Right, that we already have a deal with for another line.
Yeah, we have truckloads of those available. Let's just use that.
Yeah, we're the lousy with this suspension. And the people who say that, the people who end up kind of playing the – you could think of them as the bad cop. I think that's busting their chops a little. But those people are the accounting department, and they are responsible for something. Let me ask you this, Scott. Did you ever have a car where somewhere on the console or the dash there were blank buttons – that were just like a slap in the face to the options that you didn't get in your car?
Almost every car I've ever owned, really. I mean, that's the truth, is that, you know, there's always going to be that spot where, you know, there's a spot for a button there, or even three buttons, or whatever it is, and you wonder, what the heck is that? Until you find a vehicle that is of a higher line than yours. Let's say you bought, you know, I'm going to just make a Mustang. You buy a Mustang, and then you go look at a Mustang GT, and you find out what that button hole was for, right? But you've just got a blank panel there, a little piece of plastic, and that, again, kind of a slap in the face, right? I mean,
yeah,
like,
why don't I
have that option on my vehicle? And if the hole's there for it, why isn't there at least just a dummy switch there?
Right.
Why don't they put something there that, so it doesn't look like just, you know, an option that I don't have?
I had a I've had those experiences where I would hop in a car, and it was like my car, and I would look at the radio, and I obviously didn't have the cool version of the radio. So there's a big blank space in this one area, and then where the hazard lights would be, there's that one button, and then there's a row of other unlabeled buttons that don't work.
Yeah, it's like the fog lights or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
And every time I hop in, I feel like my car's. Pardon my French here. Every time I would hop into my car, I feel like it was saying, "You cheap bastard." Thanks for at least getting wheels.
You know what? I think a lot of people feel that way about those blank buttons. Like, why do you even have to have that opening? Why does that have to be there? Why can't they just make a separate dash for this level vehicle?
Just give me the one button I need.
Yeah, exactly. So okay, he has a perfect example of this. Now, this is, again, from Mr. Car Designer over at Jalopnik. He says, for example, say your car is available with a sunroof, but you bought the base model. And then he says, so really you brought this on yourself by doing that. But the car with the sunroof needs to have a hole in the dashboard for a sunroof switch. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
All right. Your car does not. I mean, it doesn't need it. You don't have a sunroof. So that's the reason. But, well, that seems simple enough. But what you may not have considered is how a dashboard is manufactured right now. So there's no employee whose sole purpose in life is to drill holes in dashboards for sunroof switches. Almost all dashboards on the market today are injection molded plastic, and that means that a mold has to be designed and cut from a large piece of metal for every single variation of a part. Now, that's every part. That's not just the dashboard, but we're talking about the dashboard here. A mold as large as an entire dashboard can easily cost millions of dollars. So, you know, that's the reason. They're not going to make two separate dashboard dies for, you know, your dashboard, because it cost them millions of dollars. Now, think again with the profit margins that we told you earlier, how small they are in some vehicles. And others, I understand it goes up a little bit as you go up in trim level, but still, they're not going to invest millions of dollars. They're going to look at that and say, well, no, we're just going to give you, you know, a 2 cent blank to put in that spot instead of, you know, creating a whole new die or mold for that whole thing.
Yeah, because think about it. In order to have a variation of the dashboard with that sunroof switch and one without that sunroof switch, so that you, like me, would not feel like you were incredibly cheap when you hop in your car, it would cost the company millions just to have those.
And the funny way he puts it is that it would cost – if you think about it this way. So you understand, like, you can't have a separate dash. It costs millions of dollars. But the reason – they don't do it is because the only thing that it solves is that it would fill, you know, 1 square inch of material on that dashboard.
That's it.
Is millions of dollars worth filling that 1 square inch of material? Never.
Not to accounting.
No, not to accounting. Well, I guess, you know what, to you and I, just do it.
I mean, if it's not my money. That's so terrible.
Yeah, they should have just done it. Just sell another, you know, 10,000 vehicles, 100,000 vehicles.
You see, I mean, clearly, right, we can see that there is a – we can clearly see there is logic at play in this decision. And honestly, although it can be irritating to see those blank buttons and stuff, it's completely understandable. And I have a hard time picturing anybody doing anything different.
Now, it's irritating, I understand, but that is accounting's job. They have to make sure that stuff like that doesn't happen. Now, another factor in this whole thing, another role that's played in car design is by the government. And we'll talk about them after a word from our sponsor.
We have returned, and here is where one of the biggest influencers in any car design comes into play. Mm-hmm. They're the people who have essentially out of the four groups, they have the strongest veto power. For any design.
Oh, absolutely. Because if they don't approve it, your car's not going to be on the road. You're not going to sell even one vehicle. So you have to design with this last faction in mind right from the very beginning. So you have to think about the government. You have to think about regulations. You have to think about what vehicle safety standards you have to meet in order to get your vehicle on the dealer lots and then onto the highways.
And not just what you might think of when we first say safety standards. Not just, seatbelts, airbags, point, like even crumple zones, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. This also means emissions. This also means, this means a bunch of different things that all get wrapped up under the approval of what we in the U.S. call Uncle Sam.
And if you want to get right down to the group or the division that this is falling on or on their shoulders, this is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA as we'll call them. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about them many times in the past. And their set of rules, or the list of rules, is known as the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, or FMVSS, which we'll just say Federal Safety Standards. How about that?
Yeah, it's an exhaustive group of regulations, and it increases every year.
Yeah, it's hundreds of regulations, ranging from airbags and airbag tests, I guess, to standards for flammability for vehicle interiors. Their regulations play a huge role in the design of a vehicle, as you said before, Ben. And as these guys said, the engineer points out early on, it's pretty easy to build a car. You can build the most simple vehicle out there. I mean, it really is pretty simple. You could take just about – you could build one in your garage and make it work, really, out of scrap that you have laying around.
Yeah, you can make it go.
You can. You can make – I mean, think about a go-kart. People build go-karts all the time.
Yeah, people like motorized shopping carts. All you have to do
is just scale that up and make a small vehicle. And I know it sounds like a tall, it's hard to do that. I understand it takes skill, but it's relatively simple to create something that could run and drive.
If you don't have to worry about safety.
That's the thing. Now, see, that's the thing. If you take that design that you create in your garage, whatever that happens to be, if it's your own design, you would still have to pass these tests. And if you're planning to sell the vehicle, I guess, that's the other thing. If you're planning to replicate and sell this vehicle, you have to adhere to the NHTSA's battery of tests. And they've got a lengthy list of tests that they have to, or crash tests that they have to, pass with some form of confidence, you've passed with one star or whatever it is. I mean, at least you've completed this, right? And, of course, everybody shopping is looking for the 5-star vehicles, right?
Of course, yeah.
And then they throw out tests that aren't yet federally mandated, but still have to be completed. The manufacturers are still, adhering to that. One example is the offset test. I think there's a small offset test now, which is different. They, for years, have ran something that they just called, the frontal crash, right? Where it's a full-on front crash, right? Mm-hmm. I think everybody can understand that. It's pretty easy. I guess they would call that the full frontal crash, right?
Yeah. There's...
Wait, isn't that one of the criteria you look for in a movie when you go to see it, full frontal?
Yeah, that's true.
All right, sorry, I couldn't resist. I mean, how often does that come up in our podcast? Not very often.
We're not really a full frontal show.
Okay, I'm ribbing you, Ben.
So inspired by the world of film, full frontal crash. That's where all the crash dummies are naked.
Yeah,
in the car.
Okay, so I guess moving on. All right, then there's the moderate frontal crash, which is from about 1995, for right around there. I'm not exactly sure the year, but that has a barrier that only contacts 50% of the front of the vehicle. And we've all seen that, right? I mean,
sure. It's
kind of like an offset barrier. Mm-hmm. They've increased that even more now in the last couple of years. I think I want to say it's around 2012, but it might have been 2014, somewhere in there. They started running something called the small overlap frontal crash. And this one only contacts 25% of the front end of the vehicle. Now, as Mr. Car Designer points out, these are brutal crashes. If you've ever seen a small frontal overlap crash, they're running about 40 miles per hour.
Right.
And you think 40 miles per hour, that's not very fast.
Until you hit something.
Until you see one of these crashes happen, and then you understand exactly how important that is. But the problem is, this completely changed the game for them when they started doing these overlap tests, where only a part of the front end is contacted. Mm-hmm. It changes the direction that the body inside moves. It changes where you place airbags. It changes the structural underlayings of the left front side of the vehicle, the right front side of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. You have to add steel beams. You have to add a lot of material. And again, everything has that snowball effect where if you add, material here, you got to take away from there, or it extends it. It changes the design of that. So when you change something like as simple as an airbag, you have to adjust your airbag design because of this 25% overlap. That changes literally hundreds of parts on a car. Hundreds.
There's a domino or a snowball effect, as you said.
Yeah. And that ripple effect or domino or whatever you want to call it, that causes a lot of issues with not only your department, with other departments as well. And so, again, that leads to a new string of meetings, a new string of CAD designs that have to go out. You have to change everything based on just that one simple thing. So, changing even the most simple thing, you would think it would be simple, it has, again, this effect that reaches to all groups. Everybody is responsible for it now.
Yeah. So if from our sunroof switch example, if you have to install a new, bigger, stronger knee airbag to stop somebody from moving sideways, then you have to factor in all of the other parts that are around it. And this can have very real and very dangerous implications. So now all of a sudden we have this bigger, stronger airbag. It could turn the sunroof switch into a deadly projectile when depending on the nature of the crash.
Oh, back to that sunroof switch again. Mm-hmm. That thing's causing us all kinds of trouble today.
I miss having a sunroof.
Do you really?
Even though they're such a hassle,
man. Just again, another little side note here.
Yeah, please.
I prefer vehicles to not have sunroofs. I don't know why that is. I've had vehicles with and without.
Yeah.
And I just seem to prefer them without. And I think one major reason is that it's a giant hole in the roof of the vehicle, and that's another potential leak spot. That's one.
Yeah.
Now, it's nice, I guess, to be able to open it to vent, the air and just have some fresh air flow through there. It brings cool air through the windows sometimes, on a fall or spring day. I like that. But a lot of times, we're here in Atlanta and it gets hot. Even if through its, they're usually really, really tinted, really dark.
Right? Yeah.
Even through the tinted window, tinted glass, those become super hot in the summertime. And I would prefer to shield myself from that sometimes, just to kind of hide out underneath the hard roof of my vehicle.
Well, my position on this kind of stuff is when I see like a retractable soft top, or when I see a convertible, when I see a sunroof, the first thing I think of is how many moving parts break so easily in those things.
Yeah, that's right.
The last time I was actually in a soft top, the person who was driving, she was showing me her new car, and she was like, "Yeah, we'll take the top down." I said, "Cool, take the top down." And the top did not come back up, my friend.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
So she had to take it into the shop that day.
Oh, yeah.
Luckily, the weather was fine.
Yeah.
But
I guess
they feel like liabilities.
Extra parts.
Extra parts, more movement equals more opportunity to break.
More movement, more trouble.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. More movement, more problems.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyways, all right. So, you're getting the idea that, you change one little thing or you add one little thing and it creates this world of complexity that wasn't there before, right? I mean, you may have everything kind of all hashed out and ready to go. And, someone down the line decides they're going to change the design of the front fascia. They're going to change the look of the headlamp. Something has to be adjusted. But that has that ripple effect that changes everything behind it, or at least a significant distance around it. So the underlaying stuff is what this engineer is concerned with. And there's hundreds of pieces that then have to be reevaluated for every little change, to make sure that there's no issues that are caused by that.
And let's get specific here with the help of Mr. Car Designer. The Mitsubishi 3000 GT hood blisters. These were originally caps added to cover holes in the hood for strut tower clearances.
All right. I have to admit that I had to look this up. Looked up I think it was like a 1995 Mitsubishi 3000 GT.
Uh-huh.
And it does have these kind of goofy-looking caps that were put in place. They look like a separate piece. They are a separate piece.
Uh-huh.
That was put onto the hood later. They smoothed them out. They made them – they incorporated them into the hood design. But it's a goofy design. So why do they have to do that?
Yeah, because there were these holes in the hood because the strut tower needed clearance that the actual hood, the pre-existing hood, just didn't have.
And they didn't go back to redesign the hood.
Right.
Yet.
Yes.
I mean, they did later.
They did. As you said, they did later. And
yeah.
Usually this sort of incorporation of these new features happens when the next model comes out.
Well, I'll tell you why. I mean, again, go back to the example of the dashboard, right? I mean, imagine how expensive it is to make a piece of metal that you have to shape in order to create a new hood for a vehicle. And so they probably just got to a point where they said, you know what, we can't spend, you know, $6 million for this new hood design right now. We're unsure about it. We'll do that on the first redesign of the vehicle, whenever that was. I don't remember how many years later that came about, but the accounting looks at it. Everybody looks at it and decides it's just not worth it at this point. Here's our simple fix for now.
Mm-hmm.
We'll really fix it later.
And sometimes that sounds like a sort of an ad hoc solution or a last minute-ish thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets the car on the road, and it gets the car in dealerships, and it gets the car out.
I have to believe that this is smoothed out a little bit with computer-aided design that we're doing now versus computer-aided design back then.
Yeah.
It was a bit more second time I've used it, a bit more primitive back then, even though it was very advanced for back then, versus the way we did it before, you know, the drafting board. But
yeah.
And they still do drafting board, I understand. But now you can – you know, input this, and the whole team is working on one system now, and
right.
I think they have been for many, many years now, but to be fair. But, you know, you make one change, and it shows you every part that it does affect, and then alerts are sent out to everybody to say, hey, so-and-so, you know, Ben's making this change on the underneath the hood.
Uh-huh.
Is that something that's going to interfere with, you know, production? Is it going to cost more? Is it going to allow us to manufacture this? Is it going to have any kind of interaction with another part? Is it going to, you know, collide with another part?
And then how much is this change going to cost?
Yeah, exactly.
What is the reference? What are our other options?
And all this is happening in real time so that, you know, when they're working on a vehicle, they can do this simultaneously. Everybody sees, you know, what changes are being made every day, all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it's very helpful. I think it streamlines the whole process. So stuff like that won't happen now, really.
Yes.
It shouldn't happen.
It shouldn't. It's much less likely to happen.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I guess when you get to the, you know, the assembly line, things are a little bit different.
Yeah, when the robot hits the road, yeah. There is another extreme example or extreme possible consequence of these sorts of changes.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Car Designer doesn't name it specifically. He says, I know of at least one vehicle, a certain off-roader, let's just say that was discontinued entirely because changing airbag regulations would have meant the entire shape of the vehicle had to be redesigned.
Hmm.
So this change in airbag regulations affected so many other parts of the vehicle that the manufacturer, whomever they might be,
yeah,
just said, let's take a bath on it. Let's call it a wash.
I wonder. You know, I was trying to think of who this might be, and my best shot in the dark answer, Ford Bronco. I wonder. I just wonder.
Yeah.
Maybe someone out there knows. Maybe they know what vehicle went away because of side airbag regulations and this design change. I mean, that shows you how, you know, dramatic this is. They did away with an entire line of vehicles because of one change to airbag regulations.
And so, this is an impulsive decision. There are people running mathematical models over, you know, if it gives us cost X to make this redesign and how many vehicles do we have to sell for how many years to just even turn a profit.
Yeah, or break even.
Or break even.
Or even close to even, just enough to, you know. Well, okay, so there's one more final point here that we want to bring up. But later at the very end of this podcast,
yeah,
I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask the listeners a question.
Okay.
Maybe even a couple of questions.
All right.
But the way that Mr. Car Designer wraps up this article, I think this is a good way to think about this. And the next time you get in your car, just take a quick look around and think about the things that you do and you don't like about your vehicle, and then realize that nothing in your car exists because one engineer didn't get enough sleep or decided to put that USB charger just out of your grasp. Designing a car is an immensely complex, exhausting process, and each part has its own story, as we've kind of told you today. I mean, think about that simple switch for the sunroof. Try to understand how all these stories come together and make one coherent, attractive, quality, affordable, safe vehicle, and you'll understand the challenge of my job. Now, I think that's a fantastic way to end this, because it just shows you how difficult, how complex this whole thing is. It's not mm-hmm. just one group that you can, you know, point the finger at and say, gosh, why did engineering decide that, you know, this USB charger should be way over here where I can't hardly get it? that's his last example here. This is perfect. But there are things in my own vehicles that I've had in the past that I've just wondered, why did they do it that way? And I'm trying to think of some specific examples, but I guess missing buttons is one.
Yeah.
That's one huge one. I think a lot of people have that question. Others are maybe unusual shifter designs, something that doesn't feel right, like where location of an emergency brake releases or a hood release.
Those are good. Those are both good
simple
examples.
Things. You know, maybe even the gas release door, you know, like if you have a locking gas cap or a locking gas door. Sometimes they put them in the glove box on the passenger side in the past. And, you know, I was thinking, well, that's a really weird spot for that. And then they started tucking them underneath the seats. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to get your hand kind of wedged in between the mechanism down there to open that up. And then they started putting them on the doors. And then, you know, now they're down underneath the dash by the steering wheel. You know, they've changed them all over the place, but there's a reason everything is where it is, and the design or the thought behind that isn't necessarily just one person, one group. It's a kind of a groupthink thing. It has to happen that way. Otherwise, it just won't work.
I have a good example for you.
Okay.
A bit of a curmudgeonly example. So, you know, I used to drive that Ford Escape, right?
Yeah.
The thing about that, being a compact SUV, is that the rear seats, the rear bench would fold down so you could carry you know, more stuff. So I won't get too in depth about the process. It was like a three-step process to fold down these seats. Mm-hmm. The one thing that always mystified me, I still never understood, is the headrest. You had to physically pull them out. You know, so it's a pretty basic headrest with, you know, the upholstered part and then two metal rods. The notch on one side.
Yeah, I think everybody can picture that.
To adjust that.
Yeah.
But you'd have to pull them all the way out to lay the seats flat.
Yeah. And then what do you do with the headrests?
They're just there.
They're just floating around the car, right?
That's what, you know, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe they somehow folded and I was just being a doofus. But, it got me because I would fold these things down and be loading up a car, you know, to move or something or take some stuff for a project. And then I would think, well, I lose things all the time. I better make sure that I keep these because I don't want to be driving around with a weirdly missing headrest.
Yeah, what do? You put them in the garage or you just kind of stash them on the floorboards? What do you do? I mean, that's kind of a bad design. It really is a bad design.
It feels weird.
Yeah, I understand. Well, what if you just like smash yourself right up against the steering wheel so that your chest is right up against it then and you're driving that way? Would that have worked?
I guess that would be, you know.
It's super dangerous.
Well, that's the thing. The thing about that is at least if there were an accident, it'd be over quick for me.
Yeah. It'd be over real quick.
That's pretty morbid.
I guess I understand, you know, in order to do it properly, you had to remove the headrest. That's just a terrible design. That's a perfect example. Like, why did they do it that way? But, you know, the back seat requires headrest now. You know, that's probably part of one of the NHTSA standards or regulations that they must meet, right? For, you know, I guess so that the rear seat passengers, it's probably a whiplash reducing effort or something like that, right? That's probably why they were there. All right, so Ben, I think we've pretty much wrapped up, you know, the complexity of why, you know, a car is kind of boring, I guess, in a way. Why it's not always the flash, why it's not always, you know, an exotic supercar-looking economy vehicle. You know, it's difficult to do that when you're dealing with, you know, limited budgets.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with, you know,
multiple groups.
The restrictions of an assembly line that, you know, is often nearly entirely robotic in some cases for, you know, these economy cars that roll off, you know, dozens every minute, you know, whatever the pace is, really.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of restrictions, a lot of regulations, a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes that we just don't see, we don't understand until we really start to think about it or talk to somebody like Mr. Car Designer and then understand, you know, what they're dealing with, their limitations that they're dealing with, you know, the parameters that they have to meet in order to get that approved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's probably a valuable lesson it was a valuable lesson for me. I mean, I understand now, you know, what's happening and why a cheap car, it looks cheap, right? Why
right.
It doesn't necessarily have the flash of a Jaguar. It doesn't have the pizzazz of a, a Panos or something like that. You know, I was trying to think of a PV.
Yeah, but, I think you nailed it. Well, there's and why the materials seem to change or maybe even degrade over time.
An obscure sports car. I had to bring up an obscure sports car as my example for the P vehicle.
Like it has pizzazz.
I guess so. How about
Pinto? The pizzazz of the Pinto?
Pizzazz of the Pinto, sure. No, that's definitely not one. All right, so I said I wanted to wrap up with a question or two for our listeners and for you, Ben. The question would be, now, think about this. If they really could design, you know, some of the smaller cars with a lot of style, a lot of the features and excitement, I guess, that some of the exotics have or the sports cars have, right? Say you want to get a $12,000 vehicle that looks just incredible. A real head turner, right? Without adding on a bunch of stuff that you bought, you know, at the local auto parts store. I mean, if you want to add, you know, fins or, you know, whatever, vents and side skirts, whatever.
Uh-huh.
All right. So you don't want to do that. You want to buy a car from the factory, but would you really ever want to drive like a stylish sports car or an exotic car that doesn't have the power behind it like an exotic or a sports car does have? Because you'd still be getting the economy driveline with that. You'd still be getting, you know, that 1.8 liter naturally aspirated 5-speed manual transmission vehicle that, you know, doesn't really have any get up and go compared to the vehicle that you're trying to look like. And it would just be kind of like you're kind of like a poser. Like you're like saying,
yeah,
like,
I don't like that, man.
I don't think I do either. I mean, it's like, you know, you'd have the look. You just wouldn't have, you know, the anything to back it up.
I would much rather have a car that it looks like, you know, looks like an early 90s Volvo or something, and it's still maybe even earlier, like an 80s Volvo. Okay, so
okay.
Picture it.
Sure,
we're this is very boxy right now.
Oh yeah.
And have it perform like a high powered exotic car.
So a sleeper.
I'd much rather have a sleeper because the idea, it might be for some people, but the idea of having a car that appears to be, you know, one of the apex predators of the road and not being able to back it up, that's just dirty.
Okay, now I'm not pointing fingers, I'm not being disparaging in any way towards a certain vehicle here, but I'm going to mention a certain vehicle and a pair of vehicles maybe.
Okay.
And I'm actually a fan of these vehicles. I like them, okay?
All right.
Don't get me wrong when I read this, but
okay, this is just saying.
But think about this. Now, this is a lower line vehicle. It's not the bottom of the line vehicle for either of these manufacturers, but think about the Toyota FRS, now to be known as the Toyota 86. Or the Subaru BRZ, those vehicles. You remember? We've talked about those in the past,
yeah.
Right? They're both
comparable
looking vehicles. They're both roughly the same exterior wise. They've only got like 200 horsepower, maybe 205 horsepower, which is plenty strong for a small vehicle like that, right?
But they look like they should do more.
They look amazing. Those are great looking vehicles. So that's something that Toyota and Subaru combined, you know, as a combined effort, have done very well. They've made a great looking small vehicle that's still affordable. It's not an economy car. It's not, you know, the base level vehicle, but it's lower in the lineup, I should say. But they don't necessarily have like an overabundance of power. That's what I mean. I know you can tune these and you can change them. You know, you can add upgrades. You can do whatever you want to make them a lot stronger. But right from the factory, they look fantastic. They perform pretty well, but not at the top level that you might expect the way that looks. I mean, it looks like a fast vehicle. It looks really fast, like an almost not exotic, but it looks like a sports car. It is a sports car.
Yeah.
But again, 200 horsepower, 205, somewhere around there. That's not necessarily like, you know, when you jump into a car that has, you know, 500 horsepower or 600 horsepower
right.
And has the looks to go along with that 500 or 600 horsepower. It's not the same thing. And again, I'm not trying to be disparaging towards, you know, Subaru owners or Toyota owners of that vehicle, because I think they look great. But that's just one example, like how they've kind of upped their game. They've made, you know, some of these lower end vehicles look really great. They can do that.
Yeah.
But the problem is, and I don't know if they're running into this. I haven't really even looked up the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You can make an economy car or a cheaper car look fantastic. You really can do it, and it'll cost them a little more.
Sure.
But the problem is they might not sell a lot. Sure, there are going to be people that, you know, are enthused about, you know, very excited about it. There's
right.
going to be one group that has to have that vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is going to say, I think I'll pass. I'm just going to go on something that's a little simpler, Keep it easy. Keep it simple. I'll buy the manufacturer, the make that is the competitor in that group.
Right.
For whatever reason. Maybe they don't want the flash. Maybe they don't want the attention that something like that would draw. So, you know, you think just like as a knee-jerk reaction that would be a great idea is for them to create something that it looks like an exotic and is an economy vehicle. But that might not be the case for everybody. Not everybody is going to love that the way that you might love that.
Point though, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the weight to power ratio. A lot of these manufacturers, these cars, are creating vehicles that overall do pretty well with 205 horsepower.
Oh, and I think that the FRS and the BRZ do. I think that they're performers, but they're not necessarily at the level that you would get from, you know, again, a $60,000, $80,000,
right,
or even a $100,000 car. You're just not getting that. But for, you know, $25,000 or whatever they cost, I think I'm close there, maybe 30.
We're ballparking.
Yeah, somewhere around there. They're a fantastic vehicle. They really are. Mm-hmm. And probably worth it. They're probably worth every dime.
So I guess we would want to know what you think about this too, listeners. Scott, I owe you an apology because I believe in the beginning I misinterpreted a little bit with the Toyota and Subaru examples you have. I think they are competent cars.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're the kind of thing you should be ashamed to have at a traffic light. However, there are some other examples of cars that would, you know, that look like they should be doing much better than they do.
Should we name names? No, let's not name names.
I don't know. Maybe that's its own episode.
I have a list of cheapest cars for 2017. You know, that Nissan Versa sedan was right at the top. But
yeah. But it is what it is. Nobody's going up by a Nissan and going, uh-oh, better start revving for the straightaway.
Let's just throw out Mitsubishi Mirage there, just because I want to. Yeah, that's one. Okay, so anyways, there's a whole bunch of vehicles that, you know, you can still get into that maybe aren't the flashiest vehicle, but they suit the purpose. You know, they get you where you have to go.
Right.
They're maybe not the most fun vehicle to drive. And they look a little bit plain, you know, sure they do, but they're getting a little bit better maybe as time goes on. We're in 2017, 2018 model years now.
Yeah.
They are getting a little bit better when you consider what it used to look like, what the economy car, what the base vehicle used to look like back in the 80s and 90s even earlier.
It just hit me though when you said that, man. We're in October right now. This is 2018 model years are coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh man, yep. What have I been doing with my life? Well, let us know what you think about this. I personally would always prefer a sleeper car.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. I think I would prefer something that you just don't expect, you know, okay. Something that's unexpected. It's a surprise.
Speak softly, carry a big V8.
Yeah.
You know?
Nice.
It was okay. Not my best work.
Oh, it was good.
Thanks, man. Yeah. So we are going to hit the road today, but we will be back very soon with a brand new episode of Car Stuff. In the meantime, if you would like to hear more behind the scenes explorations of car manufacturing, we have our entire catalog of podcasts available for free at carstuffshow.com.
And more on the way, we promise.
And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, where a lot of stories that maybe weren't enough for a full episode pop up. So let us know what you think. You can also talk to your fellow listeners, which I think is really cool when you see people getting conversations about stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that happens.
And in the meantime, if you're like Scott, Ben, Super Producer Tyler, I've got some super secret insider info about the manufacturing process of insert company X here, or I have some very strong opinions about sleeper cars versus these, let's say, chameleon cars that look like something else, right? Then we'd love to hear from you directly. You can email us at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.